Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 353.
This week on the podcast, the whole world's in the streets to protest police brutality.
But Trump's in a bunker declaring martial law.
Police are rioting.
Mayors are failing.
But might we finally see some policy change?
Oh, and hey, for the people in the back, Black Lives Matter.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yes.
What a week, you guys.
Wow.
What a week.
Yes.
You might have noticed, or 2 weeks, because you might have noticed we didn't come to you last week. That was for two reasons.
Right.
One being that we felt like maybe we didn't want to just wade into a discussion without thinking really carefully about how we wanted to talk about this week's Black Lives Matters protests. And then also, we had postponed the podcast anyway last week. And in
back when the most important thing on our mind was whether or not you could or couldn't go out because of coronavirus, I was walking around Joshua Tree, panicked about whether I should be walking around Joshua Tree.
That's right.
Or not.
But in the middle of that weekend, we also just had like a crazy situation happen in our neighborhood because, you know, on Saturday we had a big Black Lives Matter protest here in West Hollywood, which I attended. And that was the second in two nights of just like brutal police response to protesters that then ended up resulting in looting, resulting in fires being set in stores. In storefronts, like right in our immediate neighborhood, resulted in the National Guard being called in, and resulted in just like a zillion what would have been peaceful protesters getting arrested in like the middle of the night. Like literally, we were able to watch CNN of footage from down the street of police detaining protesters who were just sitting quietly waiting to be arrested, basically.
Well, and I liked how you framed that also, because that's it's been an important thing that I think that people, you know, need to realize, and we saw it here, certainly in Los Angeles. I was not at that Saturday protest, but I know that you were there, and also I know a lot of people who were there, and we've seen, you know, visual proof now of this, and we're going to get into that a little bit. But I mean, that protest that you were at on Saturday that ultimately turned into, you know, that Saturday, which was crazy.
Which was mayhem here, yeah.
Was fine until they met the police barricade.
That's right. Well, and what's always interesting about, because I was very careful. That was my first big protest of the cycle. So it was my first big coronavirus outing. And I was being very conscious about the possibility that that could happen because I have attended many unpermitted large protests in my time. And one thing I know about unpermitted protests, which generally are protests that are more current and more needed and more important than permitted protests, so they're often more important to attend, is that you just don't know what you're going to get. So half of that crowd went and marched all the way to Beverly Hills and had a fine time. And half of that crowd ended up in a scene of like fires and, you know, rubber bullets and tear gas on a street that is like a really major shopping thoroughfare right in our immediate neighborhood. And so that that was literally, they were just two marching groups that went on two different streets. And that was the difference. So I, you know, as somebody who, you know, already is trying to be careful about coronavirus for my own health reasons, chose not to attend the sort of later part of the march of that protest because we knew that the LAPD had been handling things poorly. And it fell apart fast. And it really, I mean, as you know, I can understand why people got so alarmed about all these looting reports. It really, on Saturday here, it felt lawless. And then on Sunday, the looting in Santa Monica started at like 2 p.m. And the looters were sort of free for all in, you know, in a major shopping thoroughfare there as police held off a protest, a Black Lives Matter protest that had been organized by moms in Santa Monica, as if that was like their most pressing concern.
Well, and that was the thing that we learned fairly quickly. And I'm glad, too, that the, you know, the, especially here, I mean, there were so many times where I was watching the local news, and if they wanted to show both the protest and the looting, they had to be on a split screen in like two different parts of town, basically, or like two completely different, you know, areas of the same city. Like that night of, I think it was when they were in Long Beach. It was like the, you know, people were like looting a supermarket that was nowhere near where the peaceful protest was happening.
Yeah, so, like, so for like 3 days, we just had like...
It didn't take long for that to be realized. And also, we've all seen the memes now. Like, we shouldn't be focused on the looting anyway. And we're not. But like, we're just sort of like giving you a little context for...
Well, context for what we were going through, which was a weird situation, to say the least. And was very alarming, if you know, especially for... You know, I was home alone that night. Like, there was no real sense of what was and wasn't possible. Fires were being set all over our neighborhood. I think the other thing that I try not to do is maybe dismiss the connection between the protests and the looting to the extent that I kind of rob what were protests that were filled with righteous rage of the of their teeth. Because people were really upset at those protests, rightfully so. And that is also a thing that happened. And that was not a thing that was instigated 100%. By the protesters themselves. But the protesters were met with brutal police force out of the blue without warning. Yep. And they reacted as crowds do when they are met with brutal force without warning. And that was something that was happening alongside the peaceful protest, the looting, all of it. It was all part of the same outcry in a lot of ways. So that's not to sort of like rob any of the protests of their agency either, because I think that was, I think the other narrative that often bothers me is the idea that like everything is a peaceful protest and then there are just a few bad actors doing bad stuff, because this was not a peaceful protest and there were reasons that it was not a peaceful protest. Sure. And it is because the very thing that we were there to protest was happening while we were there. You know, the protests were about police brutality and the police were brutal at them.
Right. And they were met. Right. And the protesters were met with said police brutality.
Exactly. And so, you know, they were violent protests in parts, not the parts I was in, thankfully. But there were reasons for that. So I want to talk before we move on from just the general idea that there were protests about one thing that I have found really exciting about this moment, which is... So, we've had protests every day since last Friday.
Yeah, I think we're on day, like, 13, ultimately, at least in the country anyway. But
And what it seems now to be, what seems to be happening here in L.A. that I have found really exciting is that instead of some group trying to, mobilize some large protest in downtown L.A. that is, like, seen by zero people and that maybe a zillion people attend and then have to figure out their way home from, we've just been having protests where we live. You can go to as many of them as you want. I have been to like four of them this week.
I ended up at a protest today.
Just
because
you were waiting.
In error.
Yeah, exactly. So, like you.
I was happy to be there. But I mean, it was like one of those things where I was like, oh, I'm in this area of town. I guess I go to this protest over here.
I had a protest on Wednesday where I went in the morning and then heard helicopters circling my house later in the afternoon, like 5 hours later. And was like, oh, they're back, and just went and rejoined the protest. So
I know, you can sort of, it's,
you can just sort of hop in and out as you need to.
It's a little, it's a little disconcerting, all of the helicopters that have been going. But like, if you hear one overhead, then you can assume that you can probably go outside and find a protest.
Exactly.
It's like they're annoying to be there, but they're also
they're alerting us about the importance.
They're like a GPS.
But yeah, I want to say that the one thing that I think has been different about this moment and interesting about this moment is that the protests have been visible everywhere because of that. So one thing, Black Lives Matter said very specifically that they consciously chose to hold protests in places like West Hollywood because they wanted them to be visible to the kinds of people who just aren't as active or engaged in issues that deal with not only police brutality in general, but specifically police brutality against Black people.
Exactly.
And so they came to white neighborhoods to hold these protests.
And percentage-wise, there's less Black people in West Hollywood. Ditto, they've also spent a lot of time in Beverly Hills. Ditto Beverly Hills.
Exactly. Santa Monica. So they were very specific about and conscious about holding protests in places that do not normally have protests like this visible in their neighborhood. And what has happened is that they've become incredibly visible here because now, no matter where you go at any time of day in this area, you accidentally run across. I drove somewhere at 7:30 last night and just happened upon a protest on La Brea that was just making it was one block worth of people making its way up La Brea. And like that is happening everywhere. And I think in many ways, like I feel like I'm learning a lot from this actually because I would not have thought to myself that this would be a more effective way of organizing, but it really is. Small protests everywhere are really effective, not only because the protests themselves are impressive, but also it means that the people coming to and from the protests become their own mini protest. And so what you're seeing is groups of 5 people.
There's been a lot of like car caravan protests.
Right. But you also, when you and your 5 friends leave the protest with your signs, you're essentially holding a medium protest on your way home. And so the sort of movement has become very visible in a way that I think has been really exciting. However, obviously, it's been exciting in good and bad ways this week.
Right. Well, and we should also say, too, you know, as we sort of like go through, you know, the rundown and talk about the news here, you know, we're going to talk a lot about sort of like what this means politically, or at least what we think it means politically anyway. You know, I mean, we've been to the protests, but, you know, we're not going to be, we'll probably be posting a lot on social, and we have been also anyway, but just in terms of like a daily action item, like that's like, there are places for that.
We're not experts in police policy.
Also,
so we don't know what it is to be a Black American, and we are not going to try to claim any sort of insight into that experience. What we
100%
are going to talk about and or focus on is, you know, there were some political turning points this week that were prompted by these protests. And there were electoral turning points this week prompted by these protests. And there were some policy discussions prompted by these protests that we are really interested in having. So these are not policy areas that we are the source on, but the sort of the way that it is having a ripple effect on the electoral system and the political system in general is something that is both interesting to us and something that we have been trying to take special note of. So that's what we plan to discuss today.
Yeah.
I think there has been rightfully a lot of sort of discussion about how, you know, how a podcast like this that's hosted by 2 white people in West Hollywood can sort of have a meaningful discussion about this issue. And we are not here to replace any conversations that are actually about, you know, that are about what it is to be Black in America, but also what it is to be an expert in the kind of policy changes that we need to see here. And so we want to talk about the thing that we do know about, which is elections and the political process. And to some extent, protesting, because that is something
that
we know about. The first thing I think is that there were sort of rippling turning points this week, because after the story started to turn from being a news story about looting that largely ignored the meaning of these massive protests that we were seeing that were about George Floyd's death, that were about police brutality, that were about what has been like an increasingly militarized police presence everywhere in America, and that has been marshaled specifically to endanger the lives of Black people in America. There was a sort of change in the tone of coverage, not a perfect change in the tone of coverage, that started on Monday, and it started because of a 10-minute sequence on television that was one of the craziest things I've ever seen in my life.
So wild.
Donald Trump was hiding in a bunker all weekend. Protests breaking out everywhere. Cop cars are on fire. Police stations are on fire. He's hiding in a bunker.
Did you hear that interview with him where he said he'd been down there 2 or 3 times and then finally settled on 2.5 times?
I did. And that
he's been down there 2.5 times. He has to go down and inspect it and then do other things.
Right.
Exactly. So it's like, it was like 2, wasn't 2, but it wasn't 3. So he's been to, this was the 2.5 time that he's been to the bunker.
Right. Exactly. So the 10-minute sequence begins with Donald Trump deciding he's going to finally make a public comment.
Right.
Now, as you know, maybe based on his track record from his time commenting on the Charlottesville white supremacist rallies, he's not always got a great sense of what the appropriate thing to say and thing to do is in a crisis point like this.
Right.
He came out and made comments where he vaguely talks about protecting the rights of peaceful protesters while also kind of declaring martial law.
Right, saying that he would send in the
He sent not just the National Guard, but the military.
The military.
This is right after he's
called active military.
That's right after he's called all the governors weak for not somehow squelching these protests single-handedly with force.
Now, he can't do that per the Constitution, by the way.
Right. If you were just wondering about law, but he's not wondering about law, so why would we?
No.
But so in any case, in a split screen, as he is delivering these remarks, just outside the Rose Garden, there's a big protest going on, as there has been for days.
The peace among featuring the peaceful protesters that he is at the time.
Correct. Protecting the rights of in his comments.
Protecting the rights of, yes.
And what are these random unmarked federal forces that are definitely not DC police and not even really Capitol police and no one's really sure who they are doing to these peaceful protesters?
Rubber bulleting them.
Obviously. So literally in a split screen, as Trump makes his first comment in days in the midst of like a mass wave of protest, he is tear gassing the protesters that he is complimenting for their First Amendment rights.
You can hear it during his speech, even in the non-split screen
part. You can hear it in the background of his speech. And he's doing it not because there's even a fake present danger. He's doing it so that he can do a photo op in front of a church.
He's got to get over to the church. With a Bible that he does not know how to hold at all.
Familiar
he shakes it at one point as if it's like a replacement for like a magic eight ball or something. Like if you you shake it, you get a different answer at the end.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of my favorite Trump quotes is the time that somebody asked him if he had a favorite Bible quote.
Oh, right.
And then also a favorite Bible book. And it was too personal to do a quote. And then when they asked him if he likes the New or Old Testament, he says, well, I would say both equally. And then proceeds to refer to them as a single book from then on.
Yeah.
So in any case, he does all of this. This scene that looks like it, you know, is something that we have watched happen in horror in other countries where, like, people are having chemical weapons. Tear gas is a chemical weapon, P.S. People are having chemical weapons used on them by
the... later in the week, I think, that they didn't do that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He also tried to gaslight us about it after it happened on television. There were reporters in the crowd that was tear gassed.
Right.
Like, the coverage is crazy because it's, like, cameras flying everywhere and, like...
That's some screaming. Assad shit, though.
It's some Assad shit, exactly.
Yeah.
And so he does this, like, Assad shit, denies it happens, and then Bill Barr has to take credit for it because no one's really sure who should take credit for it and bite the bullet on that. And then he just gets, like, roundly lambasted by every church leader in D.C., including the clergy at the church that he was doing the photo op at.
So good.
And then, Mattis finally came out and spoke against him. We're starting to get some pushback from Romney and Murkowski in the Senate. Right. Like, suddenly everyone...
Romney was at the protest today, by the way.
Like, shit has gotten crazy.
Yeah.
And
he also put out a picture of his dad at the Civil Rights March, which was met sort of, you know, with some...
With a thumbs... A little bit of pushback thumbs down.
Online.
Right? Yeah. Yes. No, but I mean, that moment was actually, I think, really galvanizing. And the reason I'm singling it out as a moment that was, I think, impactful in my impression of things was because I have a very close friend from childhood who does not consider herself to be like an activist, is politically far more moderate than me, is somebody who likes to work on solutions and logic and whatever. You know, like she doesn't like my bombastic style of politics a lot
nonsense.
Of the time.
Right, of course.
And she woke up the next morning and just like walked out of her house and joined a protest. And it was because of that moment. And so I think, and she, you know, she lives in DC, so she joined that protest. That to me was like a really astonishing moment because it was a moment that friends of mine who had not been engaging in the police brutality discussion, had not been engaging in the sort of racist policing practices discussion, suddenly were engaging in all of those discussions. And it was because they watched this crazy 10 minutes on television.
I think so, too. I think this was even... That specific 10 minutes, I think, is what really sort of gave a lot of people sort of like, and I can't believe that it took until now.
Well, of course.
But it like became the moment where he had gone a step too far.
When I also...
Like, I feel like he's going a step too far like every single day since he was inaugurated.
Right.
But like that was, a lot of people who don't even usually like comment on policy. Like these people who like Mattis, Some of these other, a lot of other former sort of like defense secretaries and people in the military. Military people don't usually comment on things that can be seen sort of like as political, because they like to sort of, especially sort of like these four-star guys, you know, sort of like to try and like keep up the appearances that like the military is like separate from politics.
Well, and
like,
that's what
we know it's not, but they sort of like,
that's
like
what was
to pretend that it is
here, because people in the national security space do not, they're very careful about moments where military gets called in into domestic disputes. That's something that a lot of people in the national security space are deeply uncomfortable with, for good reason, because they should be deeply uncomfortable with. And I think it is something that that violates their like essential sense of what is and is not appropriate as a role for them. Because if you are somebody who does think that U.S. military practice abroad is fine, then you are somebody who's willing to maybe do this to other countries. But I think the one sort of area I think that often sort of military leadership and regular civilians agree on is that the military should not be called in to a domestic dispute like this. That is not the role of the military. And I think they know their credibility very much relies on them staying independent of stuff like this. And so when Trump in that speech said he was going to call in the military to help these governors
sort of
quell these wild protesters. And I think it was so shocking that I think that is part of why the looting and all the other stuff just ended. Because it was only a couple more nights that any of that stuff went on. And I think it was just like the protest got too big, because people like my friend just walked out their door and started protesting.
Right.
And so it was no longer just the sort of the same cadre of Black Lives Matter activists that have been driving this whole thing and like keeping the fire burning this whole time.
Yeah.
It was suddenly like everyone saw a layer in which this started to affect them personally, even people who had previously not been that interested in protecting Black lives. And that is why I think you started to see some change among people like Romney and Murkowski, who are not walking around bemoaning how the police treat Black Americans.
No.
You know, but they certainly know when the military being called in on American protesters.
Right, they're also not trying to use, they're not trying to use the military on their own citizens either.
Meanwhile, Monday was crazy beyond that as well, because Monday was also the day that our police chief here in LA made a comment that got him in hot water and basically created the world's greatest 8 hours of YouTube television in the following day. First of all, our police chief here is named Michael Moore, which is so complicated and confusing, and they should make him change his name. Because every time someone
Make him not be the police chief is what they should
make
him.
They should make him be fired, and then also we should just stop having to refer to him. There's another Michael Moore already. We don't have time for this many Michael Moores. In any case, he was at Garcetti's press conference on Monday night and made a comment that kind of implied that the looters had George Floyd's blood on their hands. He said, "We didn't have protests last night. We had criminal acts." A, that's not true. We had both. We didn't have people mourning the death of this man, George Floyd. We had people capitalizing. His death is on the is on their hands as much as it is on those officers. And people were like, "Are you fucking kidding me?"
Yeah.
There is not a good time to try to imply that protests that maybe even have involved looting that happened in the aftermath of police brutally murdering an innocent man on video had caused that murder somehow.
Yep.
But certainly this was the worst time that he could have said that of all the times. There's not a time that I don't think this would have maybe been a problematic thing to say, but that happened on the heels of us watching this crazy scene unfold at the White House. It happened in a city that was being sort of, that was under really strict curfews, that our curfews here were much earlier than anywhere else in the country.
Yeah,
our curfews
here were starting at like,
the business curfews were 1 o'clock here. Our like life curfews were 4 o'clock. So we were all stuck in our homes watching this man do this. We were glued to our televisions because it was nothing but sensationalistic coverage of looting. And that he got on television that night and said this and didn't expect the blowback he got. You know, he kind of tried to walk it back in a really half-assed way right after.
Right.
And then the mayor did a half-assed apology. But that...
Well, and I want to talk about that, actually, too. Because, you know, I think that this sort of, like, crystallized a moment for me the next day after Michael Moore said this, because, you know, well, we're going to talk about the LAPC meeting in a second. But in terms of what Garcetti said about it, because obviously he was asked at his press conference the next day if he was going to fire the police chief. And his response was something along the lines of, like, as soon as I heard him say that, I knew that that's not what was in his heart. And sort of like, I've known Chief Moore for almost 30 years and he's a great man and blah, 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 blah. And like, that is sort of, at least in large part, part of the point of what we're all fucking doing here.
Yeah.
Is that, like, well-meaning white people who don't fucking get it.
Yeah.
Don't get to be police chiefs.
Right. No, that's...
Like, I mean, there, you know, that's what we're seeing here right now. There's a whole movement right now. Part of what the movement, at least for white people, is coming to grips with the idea that they thought that they were a good person.
Right.
But, like, actually didn't know half of the shit that they should have known about, like, what has gone on in this country for the last 400
exactly.
years. And, like, to say, for Eric Garcetti to give him a pass just because he knows him and he's a nice person... That's not what we're doing here.
No, and there's also, if he is like a nice person, then have dinner parties with him. But there is someone else who's a nice person who can be the police chief here. Right. There's a million other people who could be the police chief. I think, you know, we're going to talk about this a little bit more later, but like there is this kind of narrative going on. The battle between the rhetoric of is this a few bad apples versus is this a systemic problem? And I think what we learned this week, if you hadn't already known, was that it's a systemic problem. And part of the systemic problem is that it doesn't matter if your police force is being led by the well-meaningest of well-meaning white people. If
sure doesn't.
Those people are not able to enact policy that actually keeps communities safe and doesn't victimize them instead... then their well-meaningness has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, the few bad apples idea that, like, most police are good people who just are sucked, you know, who have a few bad coworkers or whatever. Like, I am somebody who actually has spent a lot of time with people who are either NYPD or ex-NYPD because the sort of issue that I have, like, made my life on is an issue that also has a tremendous NYPD presence on it. Yeah. The 9/11 first responders, there's a lot of, you know, emergency service workers like police who I've worked with for years. And so I'm someone who knows a lot of police that I think personally are good guys. I also know that the culture that they work in and the force that they work on is not the same thing as me thinking that they personally have been nice to me personally. That has nothing to do with anything. So you do not have to think that Michael Moore is actually a bad person to understand in this moment why he is not the appropriate person to lead the LAPD. You can also think that maybe a man who would be willing to vocalize what he vocalized is maybe not a good person too. If you wanted to get, you know, really get down to it. But even if you are blind to his not good personness in that comment, you don't have to be blind to the idea that maybe he has some blind spots that are preventing him from doing a good job in what is already a problematic field.
Right. Thankfully, we got to tell him about it for 9 hours.
Oh my God. This was the greatest 9 hours of anyone's life. It was trending nationally because it was so cathartic.
It was literally at that. I mean, it really did.
We're talking about the LA Police Commission meeting. They have a meeting.
They do it every either week or month. I think
they do it every month.
I think it's
but it's
every
always
month.
At 9:30 in the morning on a weekday, and so no one can ever go. And so they see the same activists there again and again, and they don't listen to them.
Right.
This time it was on Zoom because of the pandemic.
Yep.
And it was they had a public comment period, as these meetings do. And instead of having the same Black Lives Matter, you know, Black Lives Matter organizers who drag themselves to these stupid meetings all the time to try to do something good. And, you know, then get ignored and talked over by the commission. We had 8 hours of furious public comments from everyone.
They started them at 2 minutes. And by the end, they were down to 30 seconds just because they were having trouble getting through everyone. Had they left it at 2 minutes, they would have still be going, I think, probably.
Probably. I mean, had they just taken all the callers, it would still be going. Because by about hour 8, I was like, well, I would call in if it was going to keep going on. Like, I kept thinking it was definitely going to be over. But, like... I'm not above calling in to complain to the police commission.
And it had so many different amazing energies.
I mean, Zachariah
the
Witch.
What'd you say?
Do you remember Zachariah the Witch? One of the commenters. Uh-huh. There was like a sort of section of theater commenters who had rehearsed really dramatic monologues.
Right. There was a lot of, I know we've decided that we hate this term, but a lot of Karen energy.
A lot of Karen energy. Uh-huh. And some even brilliant Karen energy, because it was Karen energy. Where they came in and they told the police commission that their body language is disrespectful. They told they came in and like lectured them like
people were like entitled people white kept person telling them style. Asking them who was taking notes because like they didn't see anybody like furiously writing
exactly,
but like meanwhile all anybody was telling them was just sort of like fuck off and die. I mean, it was like
every single person told Michael Moore he should be fired. The guy who went viral said it had like an expletive laden.
Right. He was like at the very, and he only had 30 seconds, I think. So he went very quickly. He was one of the, I think, feel like theater energy.
Clearly.
Havers. But at the end, he was like, suck my dick, choke on it.
I yield my time.
I yield my time. Fuck you.
I yield my time started trending on Twitter too, because people were being very like weirdly legalese-y in the comments. So they kept yielding time. And then someone tried to claim time at one point, and they were like, that's not how it works. You don't get to claim the yielded time. Someone tried
people
to claim the time
Congress.
That had been reserved for them. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
But
it was so good. It was exactly what
every comment
the
was
entire
brilliant.
City needed. There were like 30, 40,000 people watching this live on YouTube too. I mean, it was not nothing at all.
No, and it was also, I know people who were watching it on Instagram Live who someone was live streaming it from YouTube to Instagram Live. Like people were watching, like I would guess that like 100,000 people watched that meeting.
Yeah.
And it was, I meant to turn it on for like a few minutes and I ended up watching like 3 hours of it because I was just like riveted by all of the excitement of watching that many people call in and just be like, we actually don't plan to accept this. So sorry about that. Go die.
It was so good. But to your point about some of the things that we've been seeing this week, like just in terms of policing, I mean, you know, we have, I think, established rightly, and this has been what our protests have been this week, is the mistreatment of Black people at the hands of police.
Yeah.
But I think one additional thing that we have been blessed is the right word, but I mean, have had the opportunity to see this week is to see sort of just how police forces respond to anything. And it's not good. So obviously we have a policing problem that is specific to the Black community. And then we have a just general policing problem because police forces have cultural problems that need to either be dealt with.
Police forces have very specifically militarized in the last 20 years, because this is something 100%. I think that is was clear to a lot of New Yorkers. It's been a discussion in New York for a long time because 9/11 happened there. And so there was a day where our police became a military. And there was a day before that where they were certainly problematic. And there was certainly racist policing going on. Right. And there were certainly, all of that was also true.
But they weren't riding around in tanks.
But they didn't have tanks. And so we had like a day where this all happened to us at once. And in the rest of the country, the police forces have sort of slowly been getting army surplus. They've slowly been acquiring tanks.
There's a whole program for that.
There's a program with the military that passes, you know, surplus army equipment to them. And so I think that a lot of people really didn't realize where this had taken us. And I mean, I'm not saying that I uniquely realized where things had taken us, but I sort of watching the kind of shock with which people have kind of noticed not just the behavior of the police, but the equipment the police have, the way that they approach these scenes.
Totally.
Has been really informative to me. I, first of all, had assumed that to some extent, a lot of that militarizing was just in New York. I hadn't realized the extent to which it was national, to which small towns police forces have tanks. Like, you know, how the extent to which that army surplus was being passed along to small police departments and police departments in cities that have no reason that they would need any sort of equipment like that. And I also think that a lot of people just hadn't, because if you are not black or brown, you don't interact with the police very often. And when you do, yeah. they're usually there to protect you. And so you don't have a front, a sort of window into out of control right. police behavior in the same way. And I think this was like a moment where people were able to see that not only were they benefiting from preferential treatment by police and departments, but that right. the police department itself had changed into a different thing than they last totally. Noticed, you know, and that also, they last realized.
Right. It has changed into a different thing. And also, you know, we have just seen how they, well, in even, you know, and people have been pointing this out, but so, you know, even just in the death of George Floyd, there, you know, there was obviously the officer that killed him, but there were the three officers who did nothing.
Yeah.
So like, you can't even say that that is a one bad apple situation. That's, right. that's, that right there is sort of like proof of something systemic within the police force where like, they didn't feel like they could speak
right.
up.
Like what, those are the only four bad apples in the police department were on right. that one exactly. call. That's not what happened.
And we saw this in, you know, everybody has seen that like horrific video of the, those two police officers knocking that 75-year-old protester over in Buffalo. What you may not have heard, or maybe you did, but over 100 people, some people on the police force, some people in the fire department there, came out to protest against those two being charged. Yeah. They got charged today.
Yeah, a bunch of people resigned.
As did the police union. There's been a lot of talk about police unions having yeah. too much power well, right now, too. And some police unions, there's a couple police unions, like, in the AFL-CIO, and that has been brought up as to whether that's something that needs
say,
to be looked at.
One
but, like,
thing that I also know about from my experience dealing with police unions is they do not operate the way that other municipal worker unions do a lot of the time. They are right. often a very overtly political force that is yep. not... They often operate to protect police culture at the expense of... police salaries and benefits. Because I remember a time in New York where we all learned out of the blue one day because there was a police union contract negotiation that started the starting salary for police was so low it qualified you for food stamps. And oh, wow. we were like, you know, this also isn't a way to keep us safe because if you were going to hire public employees to do a job that's critical to our public safety, at least as we've conceived of it now, you cannot pay them starvation wages and think that they're right. going to do a good job. That's just not how it works. But so a lot of the time the police benevolent associations, which are not, they're unions, but they're not the same kind of unions that, you know, a lot of other municipal workers belong to, have kind of acted to protect the culture of policing over the actual people that do police work. And that is something sure. that is unique to those emergency services and not just public employees in general. So one of the reasons you're seeing police unions acting so insane is they've actually been acting this insane for a long time, and they see themselves as a valuable political force in the city. It's why you're seeing mayors acting weak in the face of 100%. These what are truly police riots. I mean, that my mom was the first person who said that to me earlier this week, and I was like, oh, yes, that is what's going on. The police are rioting. If people mm-hmm. are not rioting, the people are protesting. The police are rioting in response to being asked to change the way they do their job so that it's not dangerous for all of us. And right. they're doing it by rioting. And so I think the culture of just like collective bargaining and the police unions in general is actually part of the problem because they have often acted to protect the culture of policing instead of thinking about how do we protect the worker, the actual people who do policing. It's not safer yeah. for them to go in militarized, by the way. That's not right. safer for individual police people. If your father is a policeman, you don't want him in armed shootouts all day.
Right.
But that is what you get when your father is a policeman right now.
Well, and, you know, we're dealing with, you know, one of the things that we've been dealing with in Los Angeles anyway is sort of like the, you know, the city budget. And yeah. this up until, you know, we made an announcement about the budget, the police force was going to be the only part of city government that was going to get a bump in the budget. And make no mistake, that is also because of the yeah. lobbying by the police
union. Lobbying by the police union. And it doesn't improve our safety. Their lobbying is designed to make politicians and you to some degree think that more money for police is the equivalent of more safety for you. But instead, the police end up absorbing roles that they have no business doing. And that is what we're going to talk about that a little later, because we're going to talk about what yeah. the rhetoric around defund the police and abolish the police means. But part of what has gone on is that you know, in sort of part as part of their lobbying efforts, you know, there have been cuts to other services. And so the police have taken on services they have no business being involved in. Yeah. And then on top of that, the police unions are paying into the political system. And yeah. so, yeah. and they're doing that at the expense of our safety often. But
for sure.
I also think, like, these videos of, like, that video of that old man was sort of the next turning point of the turning point of later in the week. And I think that that's probably because a lot of people who have never looked at an act of police violence and seen it as a personal act in on, you know, it, that would affect them, saw that man and thought he looked like their sure. grandfather. Because, yeah. and this is something that I feel like is partly just like an internalized thing that no one can help. Obviously you respond more strongly to videos that look, you know, that you personally relate to, obviously. Like, now are we all humans? So could we all personally relate to a video of humans?
Right.
Like,
could we just absolutely. Have to pay for
but that
other...
doesn't seem to be where we are as a society right now.
Right.
And so I think one thing that was sort of fascinating about that video for me is the extent to which people who had been sort of intellectually on board with this movement and intellectually on board with these policy changes suddenly like had a moment where they were like, oh my God, my grandfather could be that guy.
Right. Oh God, the police really are terrible.
Right. The police are out of control.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think,
but I do think that it definitely added to the narrative because that was not the only one. You know, I mean, we saw it in New York City. We saw it.
There was one day last week where my entire Twitter newsfeed was the police pushing over different elderly people.
Oh yeah.
And I was just like, I'm going to lose my mind. This is too yeah. horrifying. Yeah. But yeah, you know, we saw brutal police responses in cities everywhere. So it's also, I think that shows it's a culture. It's the conception of policing that is the problem, yes. too. It's not just right. the culture of individual departments. The idea of what the role that we have given police in society right. is and yeah. how...
And that's why we're seeing all this, you know, push around, you know, to either defund or, you know...
Right.
Or
is it, we're like
police.
Really at a point where it seems like we need to reconceive of what yeah. public safety is.
Right.
Beyond exactly. just like what the police are.
Yeah.
But rabid violence, weak responses from mayors, constant protests. It's been quite a week.
It has. And certainly like everybody is, I have been, there's some polling out around this. We love to talk about polling, obviously. 80% of the country feels like things are out of control right now, which I was shocked at. Some of those people are certainly people who probably think that like Black Lives Matter people are out of control. But even still, that number being that high, I think is certainly adding to the sense of unrest that we're all
right. And
feeling
need, like,
right now.
That makes it so it means everyone is looking for a change.
Right.
Which is where you have to be to get them a change.
And polling, I found this interesting, actually. Polling amongst all races, they polled them separately, asked, are you more worried about police brutality than you are protests turning violent? And it was shocking to me that everybody got it right. White people got it the least right.
Well,
of course. Because of course we did.
Yeah.
Because we're awful. But it was at least a majority.
Yeah.
Everybody identified the actual problem of those two things as being police brutality as opposed to violent protesting.
Yeah.
So like that, I mean, since when do we ever properly identify the problem?
Certainly white people have not been doing that at any time.
No.
But I actually felt like that was sort of the sense I had on the ground too, though, where people who normally have a tendency to not think as critically about these issues when it comes, you know, when we're talking about, you know, other eras of protest, when we're talking about other kinds of political radicalism, when we're talking about whatever, were by and large, like, pretty clear on what was going on here, at least to some extent, or knew that they needed to ask questions. Like,
totally.
We're looking for answers, which...
Yeah, I mean, that has been what has sort of felt different to me, I guess, is that people are really sort of, like, seem to be interested in finding out how we got here, not just sort of being like, oh, this is bad.
Right.
Because we've had moments like this in the past where we have sort of like collectively acknowledged that like something bad had happened and that we wanted something to change. And we've even sort of been in protest of these things before. But I feel like, you know, and this, some of the action items that you see on, you know, Instagram and things like that are like lists of movies to watch and lists of books to read and things to try and learn, or like, a, you know, a lot of people are doing sort of like daily, like history lessons or whatever, like on social platforms and things like that.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like there's more of an appetite to like try and truly get to the bottom of this. I had a couple of friends from, and amongst people who I think probably were all previously well-meaning.
Right, well-meaning, you know, but that, benefiting from the system as it is, as you do when right, you're white and exactly. middle class. So, you know, I
right.
mean,
I have seen at least 10 people that I know, some of whom I went to high school with that like still live in Iowa, have a very long chain on Facebook about their thoughts after they watched 13th on Netflix.
Oh, fascinating.
Which is has been one of the most watched things on Netflix. That's always the top of the list of, like, if you look at any of those, like, things that you should watch.
I know that because it is at the top of my Netflix recommendations.
Yeah.
Even though I've already seen it.
Right, I know.
Every day.
Yeah, exactly. So. And I think that, like, there seems to be, and that's just anecdotal, but I do think that there is this sort of, like, clamoring for information. And even I have sort of like, you know, it's been a good opportunity for people to realize that, like, you don't know everything. You don't have all the answers. You can't possibly know, but all you can do is sort of like
even
try to figure it out.
Geniuses like us.
Right, exactly. I watched King in the Wilderness this week, which was like a documentary HBO did about like the last 18 months of Martin Luther King's life and how he was like trying to tie all of his things together with, like, you know, being anti-poverty. It's when he started the Poor People's Campaign. It's, you know, I mean, like, so I think that, like, everybody is just sort of like trying to get to the bottom of it, and it's sad that we're just now trying, but I do feel like there is that desire to, like, really search for answers.
Yeah
in a way that we haven't.
I think that's something also that, like that can be tenuous. You know, it could be, we're all also stuck at home and have had nothing to do for 3 months, so it could just be that people's curiosity suddenly...
Right, people are glad they have a watch list.
Right, exactly, and they needed a book list, and now they have one.
Right.
So, and we've seen this, you know, we see this sometimes with, you know, popular protest waves where suddenly everyone gets real up to date on some specific issue.
Sure.
So it can be tenuous, but I think it's sort of all that we can hope that many of the people in our lives who are not politically active, who have not shown in the past an interest in engaging in, like, really more substantive, either sort of direct action or electoral action, are
totally
at least willing to do.
Yesterday
explaining the root causes of the Black Lives Matter movement to my therapist, who had a lot of questions about things that I had never thought of to ask because, you know, she's not American. She wasn't born here. So she had just like some questions about sort of like what it is to grow up in American society and why I was so kind of like, why it was important to sort of specifically focus on Black lives, like why that talking point was so important. And I think she was trying to be careful about asking about it. She was trying to be respectful in asking about it. But she had some curiosity about it that, you know, I felt like, okay, well, this is a weird moment for me to be asked to, you know, sort of transmit some of this information in a way where she feels safe because it's my therapy appointment. But it was interesting to me because I was like, well, this is sometimes the moment that you have to do this in, you know, this is part of doing the work. So I guess, what are you going to do? I think that shows that there's curiosity among a lot of the people who I think are in our lives and not in our lives in the way that, like, we know them because we do political work with them in our lives.
Totally. And I do think, you know, they're
curious right now.
Right, exactly.
At least something.
But curiosity has to lead to something beyond curiosity. You know, I've been seeing a lot of people on social media, Black people being like, look, we're glad you're trying, but, like, you know, we're not certain that we trust you.
Right, of course.
And, like, and that, why would you? You know, I mean, like, I can't blame you for that. I have to continue, like, this can't be a, you know, you put in your notes that it felt sort of like post-16y when we were, you know, sort of like women's marching and doing those things. Yeah. And it's like, we just have to, you know, we have to stay on it. I think mostly realizes that this is just not going to be a thing that goes away. It's not going to be something that we're going to pass one law and it goes away. This goes all the way back to, I mean, good God, you're talking about your therapist, like she wasn't born here. That's fine. But part of what I think people sort of like get at when they're talking about it being systemic is that, like, is that something that, like, if you are an immigrant here, that you should, like, what's on the immigration test?
Right,
I mean, literally, we have to, if we want to, like, get rid of, like, racism, not just police brutality, but, like, right. What racism is in this country, you have to look at it in every part of society. You have to look at it in that respect. You have to look at it in education. You have to, I mean, it's not
well, that's, I think the other thing is that I think the thing that has felt very post-2016 to me is, like, people kind of, like, tweeting, like, the hashtag it can't wait thing and then posting a thing about how terrible it is for people, you know, how important it is to post on social media and then not doing anything after a week of getting bored of this. And, you know, as a white person, you have the privilege to get bored of this, which is something that, and that kind of inertia is hard to break because we try to break it all the time around various political issues in the electoral system, in the activist scene. And it often, that's the main challenge is the inertia.
I mean, we've seen it with the gun issue. I mean, everybody was fairly certain we were going to get meaningful gun control after, a bunch of school children got shot up.
But that's, that one thing that I'm hoping that people are doing here as they educate themselves about this and that I am trying to be patient with people about is drawing connections between why racist policy is actually bad in an arena that they care about more. Like, I think that is part of the key here.
Because it permeates every part of society.
It permeates every part of society. And you can see the connections once you're looking for them. But if you're someone who just, like, is going to find it trendy to think that the police suck this week, and then you're going to also remember that the police are there to protect you, so they only suck for other people and don't suck as much for you because you have not been at a protest and you're not a person of color and whatever, then maybe you also need to know that racist policing is a public health issue and public health affects you because it affects everyone. And racist policing is an education issue and education affects you because it affects everyone. Like, maybe instead of just thinking radically about how we want policing to look in America, you know, we need to keep people on board our job as people that are not organizers for Black Lives Matter, that are just doing our best to be allies and are probably going to fail and whatever. Also need to figure out where the point is that we can pull some of the people in our lives who are not going to, are not going to just, like, keep up the energy in a year.
Right.
Where is the thing that will give them a productive way to contribute? Because people can contribute productively in different ways. And so that's something to think about if you are a person who feels like maybe it's not sustainable for you to write letters to your city council person every week for the rest of your life, which is something some of us greatly enjoy, and don't enjoy railing on your congressperson's office because that's not your style.
I did so much of that this weekend. It was really... one of the few things that made me feel
if
great
I could recommend week. Anything to anyone, it would be to put all of your representatives on speed dial. It makes, I mean,
I'm
if
a
you're
blast.
Really worked up about an issue, you can call 8 people and yell at them. I mean, it's great. It's what you're looking for.
It's over.
But I think there are going to be people who don't want to do that, who it's not
for sure.
The job of the, of, like, Black Lives Matter organizers to, like, help them find where they fit. But, like, that is something that could be the rest of our jobs.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Yes. Yeah.
And that's a way, agreed, I think, to kind of maintain some momentum. Unlike, you know, 2016 was exciting for a moment because, well, I love marching and we had a march to go to every weekend.
right.
But it, sure. I think it sort of petered out in part because we were going to marches that felt like they weren't accomplishing anything. And, like, we need to sort of figure out how to make people feel like there's a reason to show up.
Yeah.
Agreed.
But
we also had elections this week.
Guys, the biggest primary day outside of Super Tuesday was Tuesday.
Yeah.
I.e. on the heels of every crazy thing that we just described to you. And that is, in fact, why we went into so much detail about those things, because the most important thing that you can know about elections in the last week is that a huge election day occurred the day after Donald Trump gassed protesters to do a photo op, the day after the LA police commissioner or the police chief announced that looters were somehow responsible for George Floyd's death, the day after the weekend in which all hell broke loose everywhere.
Yeah.
And that saw...
And what a week to rid ourselves of the scourge of Steve King.
I mean, what a world.
Could it not have been a more fitting end to Steve King?
Right.
Ugh. Good.
Taken out by the racism that gave him life.
Right. Well, and here's one thing, just per your note about what we can continue to do. Don't rest on the fact that Steve King is no longer going to be in Congress, because the guy who beat him in his primary is one half shade less worse than Steve King.
Yeah, and also
didn't run against Steve King on any policy or even on the fact that he was a white nationalist, only ran on the fact that Steve King is now not as effective as he used to be because he's had all of his chairmanships and leadership positions pulled away from him by his own party. Well, that's the only reason that Feenstra won, was just because King is now just basically like a non-member of Congress because like he can't do anything.
We also have to remember that there in the general election we have a real candidate who almost beat Steve King running almost as a Democrat, J.D. Shulton, who we met in Iowa. And
very tall. We have a picture of him towering over
very tall. but that is a race to keep your eye on, because I think actually he is not going to benefit from Steve King leaving the race. Now, is it better to not have Steve King in office? Sure.
100%.
But
like, we can be happy.
We need to keep our eye on that race. We need to make sure that we're helping defeat the candidate that defeated Steve King.
Right.
As well. There's more work to be done.
Exactly.
But we also saw the first black mayor of Ferguson get elected.
Yeah, it was exciting.
And then in terrible, disheartening news, Joe Biden finally got enough delegates to cinch the Democratic nomination.
Yeah.
Look.
And you know, let's talk about Joe Biden for a second.
We got to talk about Joe Biden.
We have to talk about Joe Biden. We do electoral politics on here. It was a week. We had elections.
That's right.
And we have a candidate, officially. Now, I don't know that I have a huge interest in spending the rest of the podcast shitting on Joe Biden, because something about it just doesn't feel great to me, even though I could probably get myself there if I had to.
Also, you know how we feel about Joe Biden.
You know how we feel about Joe Biden. But I do feel like, you know, I think we've had a few examples in the past, and look, Democrats have done it, Republicans have done it, of just sort of having the wrong candidate at a specific time. You know, I feel like Hillary Clinton was the wrong candidate at a specific time. I think Mitt Romney was,
the wrong candidate.
But you know, Republicans have done it too. Mitt Romney was the wrong candidate at that time. The thing that the Republicans were most mad about in 2012 was Obamacare, and Mitt Romney had invented it.
Right.
So you know, I would contend a similar thing is going on here, where we're mad about mass incarceration and the person who invented it.
Yeah.
Not really, but, you know, I mean, close enough.
Gave it wings.
You know, I really wish that, in a time where people are begging for change, that's what we've been talking about, that everyone is looking for here on so many levels.
Yeah.
I mean,
and,
even,
and meaningful
even before...
radical change.
Right, radical change. Even before we were... having all these protests about police brutality, we were sitting around talking about how, you know, 40 million people were unemployed, and what were we going to do about that? And how, you know...
Right, and 110,000 people have died of a pandemic.
Almost 50% of people making less than $40,000, which is disproportionately black people, are currently unemployed. We were already looking for change that was actually going to do something and had to be big to solve a big problem.
Yeah.
And now we've got an additional big problem that needs big thinking. And we've got the candidate who said aloud, proudly, that nothing was going to fundamentally change.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is disappointing. Do I think that Joe Biden is going to win? Actually, right in this very current moment, I think that he probably will. I think that there is a chance that, depending between what happens between now and November, it could be such a landslide that it might
be. That he would have actually had a mandate to do something if he was inspired to.
Right. So, if he was inspired to, right. So, like, look, like, maybe it's going to end up fine in the near term in terms of winning an election and ridding ourselves of Donald Trump. But it does just really depress me, if I'm being honest, that we just don't have somebody who feels prepared for this moment.
No. And I think I think what we're seeing right now and what I'm hoping we can continue to see, if we can continue to sort of keep our eyes on the prize here, is that people are on board with some radical change ideas. And I don't, that is not just about police brutality. We should radically rethink how we are policing this country.
Totally.
But we also need to radically rethink how our healthcare system works. We need to radically rethink how we invest in education. We need to radically rethink how we reduce poverty and how we provide housing for people. We have a lot to radically rethink here. And
that's a that's what, you know, Joe Biden's a deal maker.
And he's a deal maker.
And like, look, I get it. That's how Washington works. Sometimes you have to do that. And sometimes there are things where it makes sense that, like, you end up with a deal and sort of like, okay, well, it's better than nothing. And, like, it's not going to be the end of the world that we didn't get the main thing that we wanted. But there are some things that really, truly are all or nothing. Yeah. And I believe that wholeheartedly. And this is a conversation that I've had with a lot of friends who sort of, like, you know, fight for some sort of moderation. Certainly, racism is not a thing that we can have a deal made on. As you said, when you are pushing a healthcare bill that leaves tens of millions of people still off of health insurance, that is not a thing that we can have a half measure on, because, like, you've just spent all of your political capital passing some half-assed healthcare bill,
and people still die.
Got tens of millions unemployed. There are things that I think people are realizing right now that we have to do that are big, and that we can't accept something less than that.
Well, there's been an interesting conversation happening within this current moment of protest, actually, about that, because there was a town hall that Obama did where they introduced these sort of eight can't wait hashtag ideas, where it was like small actions the police departments can sort of unilaterally take.
Right, you can't do chokeholds anymore and whatever else.
And it, for a day, everyone was super excited, and then suddenly, once the voices, you know, behind the abolish the police movement and Black Lives Matter organizers finally kind of got their hands on it, were immediately slammed, because there is no halfway to abolishing the police. You can't just ask them politely to not use chokeholds and think that that stops Black men and women from being murdered in the street for doing nothing. You can, you can, and it is not okay to just reduce the number of innocent people that are killed by police. It is okay that that's zero innocent people are killed. The number of police murders that we have in this country, I have, among many things I've learned this week, I have learned some stats that have really concerned me. So we know that Black Americans are more likely to be killed by the police than, certainly than white Americans, but then really any other kind of Americans either.
Yeah.
And so we have a sort of sense of the disproportionate scale with which we use force and kill Black Americans who are in, you know, who... First of all, the police department shouldn't be killing anyone, if, you know, if I had my way. But whatever.
Sure.
But the number of people who are killed by the police overall in this country is still like 1,000 people a year. 1,000 people a year are being murdered by the police, by the state. We are killing 1,000 people a year. That is an outrageously high number.
Well, Justin, you know, I have been shocked by that because... You know, just here in Los Angeles, you know, we have our district attorney who's up for re-election, and the number that keeps getting thrown around, and it's an accurate number, it's not a made-up number, is 600. 600 people have died at the hands of the police, and that's not in this last year, that's since she has been in office. Right. And those are the people who have not been charged. I think almost everyone have not been charged of those, that, like, 601. Yeah,
that is...
So, yeah, it's staggering. It's
staggering, and it's also, like, it's not... just a stat, in the way that I can get very worked up about half-assed healthcare reform, because to me that means that 10 million people can, like, just go die in the gutter without anything. And that's, like, an acceptable... we're willing to sacrifice 10 million people in order to get a minorly better experience for everyone else. And and that rankles me. It also rankles me, as it should you, that literally any single person who has not, you know... who has not had due process, and even who has had due process, because I don't think it's the role of the state to murder anyone ever. I understand that there are dangerous situations that happen where, you know, people are killed by the police because they are a danger to other people. I also don't think that we should conceive of the role of policing as being something where we go out of our way or in any way allow police to kill anyone without that being a really fucking big deal.
I mean, right?
That 1,000 people is not a justifiable number of people that have put police and other people in so much danger, in such imminent danger, that there is nothing else that could have been tried first.
Yeah.
Like, that is just, that is 1,000 people that we, the people, are murdering.
Right.
And that's not that's not even a discussion about capital punishment, which is another thing I don't believe in.
Well,
but I mean, like, that is people who are being just, like, murdered out in the world by us, the people.
Yeah.
That stat blew my mind
earlier this week. Before we move on to talking about defunding the police, which you were sort of, like, just hinting at.
Oh, yeah. We first have to talk about Biden one more thing.
Right. There's one more thing about Biden, and this actually I think is perhaps the most interesting, at least to me anyway, because, you know, we love to talk about veep stakes on here. We've talked about it multiple times. Yeah. We've sort of have tried to get to the bottom of our own thoughts and feelings about who's going to be Joe Biden's vice president. None of us know the answer. Neither of us want to know the answer.
Right.
But anyway, I think an interesting thing happened this week where I think three of the options, and there are three people who we know for sure were being vetted, are probably off the list right now.
And if they're not off the list, then Joe Biden's campaign is stupider than we could have possibly imagined.
Right, because we found out some very troubling news about Amy Klobuchar this week.
Right.
We already knew that she had problems with, we probably thought that she was out before we found out all of the terrible things about how she didn't prosecute some of these, like, terrible police officers, like, in the county that she was in, one of whom is the guy who killed George Floyd.
That's right.
Now, she's talked about how, like, that actually happened either before or after she was there. Whatever. Fine. Anyway, she wasn't trying to hold police accountable for anything when she was a prosecutor there. So, also, she had the nerve to show up at George Floyd's service in Minneapolis to, like, actually get the fuck out of there. Like, nobody's trying to see you at all.
That's so true.
But also, Kamala Harris, who we talked about as part of the primary, some of her policing problems as a prosecutor and some of the things that she did as the state attorney general and then also when she was a prosecutor up in San Francisco, she does not have the greatest record. That was part of the reason why she was not, why she herself was not tracking very well with black voters in this country. You know, I think that they would probably, I think of these three people, we're about to talk about Val Demings as probably the one who, like, could potentially, I feel like, salvage something for herself out of all of this. Just because I think that, like, people do generally like her for whatever.
Well, God, she's a good congressperson. I'm not convinced that is the campaign strategy that makes you the president, but
I'm not either.
I don't dislike Val Demings as a congressperson.
Right. And then, she was, and I believe she was either the first female or first black or maybe both. I can't remember. Police chief in Orlando, Orlando, Florida. So, and they have some issues of use of force issues from while she was there that went unpunished. So it's going to be interesting to see sort of like who is left standing. I will say though, I mean, and look, you can't go around chasing this from crisis to crisis because who knows what next month is going to bring.
Right.
I have been,
Martians here next month.
I have been fairly vocal, certainly on this podcast and to anybody who will listen, about the fact that he should have been naming a vice president quite some time ago. Because it's like, why not? Like, just do it. Like, do something splashy, like, especially when he was just sort of like not leaving his basement for like 10 weeks. I'm glad that he didn't.
I was going to say, I don't agree because this is exactly what happens when you do that.
Right. I know.
Like, make it splashy later on when you're a little
eight
sure.
Weeks, I was going to say. And with the way America is going right now, it might behoove him to, like, announce it on the morning of November
2nd. I was
going to
say, announce it in early November and call it a day. Right. Just see if you can get the news cycle of election day.
Right. Use your VP as your October surprise.
Exactly. Like, things are too unpredictable right now for you to be making any promises about anything.
I know. Oh, man.
maybe even for you to be making promises about your own candidacy. Maybe things are too early for us to even be thinking about it.
Yeah.
In any case, before we go.
Yeah.
I think one thing that is a conversation I've had with a few people this week and is a conversation that I'm interested in having with as many people as want to have it is what exactly protesters are asking for and why the immediate reaction of fear you have when someone says defund or abolish the police is misplaced. Because I remember, actually, we went to a Black Lives Matter panel like years ago at Politicon, which was the first time I heard anyone say we should abolish the police. And I was like, what are we talking about?
Right, you're scandalized.
I was scandalized, and I admit that. And I also, you know, it was the first time I'd ever been faced with that idea. And it was helpful, I think, because it's always good to have someone say a radical-sounding idea to you so that you can think about it a little. And I think that, you know, it is meant to sound radical, which is why if you hear it for the first time right now, you're going to be like, oh, my God, what? No one is talking about eradicating safety from your community, right, which is, I think, the point I had to get
Let's
to.
Let's just have a lawless society.
Right. When I first heard this idea was I was like, well, you know, I'm a small woman who, you know, right. wants to be able to walk safely down the street alone and wants to be able to call someone when I'm being threatened by some man somewhere, which happens 100 times a day. And, you know, I think in particular, if you're a woman and you hear this idea, you're often like, well, like, I spend my whole life being scared. I walk into every situation trying to figure out what leverage I have in that situation because I'm scared all day, every day, and I have to think about it all day, every day, and it's exhausting. And women feel that way in general. I'm sure it is much worse if you're a woman of color because you also can't trust the authorities to even pretend to care about you. But that is something that I know was at the root of why I reacted so dramatically when I first heard this idea. Yeah. And I think the thing, you know, we have been to a couple of those panels since. We have been to a couple of other events where speakers from Black Lives Matter have described this idea and from other groups that are trying to, you know, reform policing practices have discussed this idea. And so I've learned a lot about it since then and also in the last week just because it's been a topic of discussion everywhere. But I feel like we should maybe just go over some of the like bullet points of what we're actually talking about when people say defund and abolish the police so that you don't walk away thinking that we're talking about abolishing your sense of safety in society, because no one is talking about that. We're talking about, you know, the fact that police forces right now, and we talked about this a little earlier on the podcast, have been empowered to act in situations that are not appropriate for a police force to act in the first place. So when we talk about who is doing school safety right now, when I was a kid, it was a school safety guard who knew all of us by name, knew who our parents were, who years later got replaced by a police officer who was transferred in and out of there so quick that they couldn't know who we were, who because of that was not providing the kind of caring safety environment that our school safety officer had been when I was a kid. And so we're talking about, first of all, removing the police from situations where they have no business being your first line of defense. If someone is having a nervous breakdown in your community, it should not be that you have to call the police. You should be able to call a mental health service and get them mental health treatment. You know, if someone is having addiction issues in your community, you should be able to call someone who can help them handle their addiction issues without criminalizing that addiction, because people can't help addictions. You know, if somebody in your community is being raped or you have been raped, you want to call someone who is specifically part of a task force that deals with, you know, with women or just victims of rape so that they can deal with it sensitively and appropriately and make sure you're in a safe place, not so that you call a bunch of guys who don't really know what to do in the situation who tell you you made it up and then go home. Like, you should be able to call some kind of community-based service that actually does look out for you in those situations. And so when we talk about defunding the police, we're not talking about cutting taxes. We're talking about taking some of the money that we use to like militarize our police and make them a presence in every aspect of public safety and apply those funds to more appropriate places where we can build out services that are geared to protecting people in situations that aren't necessarily appropriate for police involvement.
Totally. You're 100% right about everything that you just said. I just add on to that another thing that we have to think about when we talk about defunding the police is we have to think about, you know, if we're going to have less police officers, we're going to need to have less things that they're needing to arrest people for.
Right.
also. So yes. Some of the things that I think that we have to be thinking hard about here when we look at policing is decriminalization of sex work.
Right.
Decriminalization of more drugs, if not all.
Yeah.
And things like that, we have to look at what it is, like you said, that we're asking our police officers to do. And some of the things that we are asking them to do are potentially completely unnecessary to society.
Right. Things like don't need to be done by anyone.
No one needs to be arresting sex workers. Correct. Right.
Someone probably needs to be available if sex workers are abused in some environment because that is dangerous work.
Right.
And that person doesn't need to be an armed cop.
Right. And that's why I think that, like, you know, this is, you know, not to go back and rag on Joe Biden, which I said I wasn't going to do, but like, this is a big thing.
Yeah.
You know?
No, exactly.
And that's why also to, you know, the point we've been continuing to make on here is something that we're going to need to stay on top of. All of these things are not going to happen overnight. And I guess now's as good a time to any is to sort of talk about what's been going on here in Los Angeles, because we've been seeing this happen sort of like firsthand. The last post that we did when we told you that we were going to be late on this podcast was to call and talk about the budget, because the police were here in Los Angeles the only department that was going to get a boost in the budget because there were budget cuts, a lot of which were due to the pandemic that we were in the midst of. So people really sort of like took to that. A lot of people made calls. A lot of people sent emails. A lot of people posted about it. A lot of people called that police commission, and that was a hot topic during that 8-9 hour event too, was that they shouldn't have as much money. And we saw the next day Garcetti come out and say very victoriously,
of course,
that they were going to identify between $100 and $150 million in cuts to the police force to reinvest as part of $250 million that were being reinvested into like community programs. And a lot of people, including at least me in a knee-jerk way, was sort of like, we did it. You know?
Right.
It was like, we won. Yeah. We got one. And then...
found out how big the police budget actually is.
Right. It's between like $2 and $3 billion, I think.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's like...
It's like a $3 billion police budget.
An amount of money that $150 million of just forces them to buy cheaper office supplies.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe that's a part of a bigger thing that we are about to undertake here.
Yeah.
I didn't get the sense that it was.
Well, I think it is part of a bigger thing that we, the people, are about to undertake. People.
Yes, but not...
not the city government doesn't seem interested in undertaking it without our direction.
Like, and you sort of have to think about how that number was arrived at. Like, you know, after I sat and thought about it a little bit longer, I was like, I bet they okayed that with the police department.
Obviously.
You know? Obviously, because they obviously talked about it, like, amongst the city council and, you know, the board of supervisors. Yeah. Like, that number was not just made up by a person. That was a number that was identified, I presume, to allow the police force to continue existing as is, but just have a little bit less money.
Yeah. No, this is, I think, part of, like, there are a lot of places where we spend huge amounts of money on services we don't need that could be invested instead on services we do. Like, that's, a majority of people that are in jail right now are there for nonviolent crimes. We don't need to be paying to jail those people. No, we should be paying to have programs so that people can do things other than commit nonviolent crimes for a living. You know, we should be providing community support in communities where there are a large number of nonviolent offenders. There are plenty of our justice system is very much about making people pay for their crimes as opposed to rehabilitation programs that would allow people to move on with their lives and not have to commit crimes in the future.
Yeah.
And we conceive of justice as being this, you know, as being retributive, as being based in the idea that, like, people who commit crimes deserve retribution for committing those crimes, instead of being about what would make society function most effectively. And a lot of the money that we spend on policing, in addition to going to things that, like, just don't need to be policed, like, you know, are just not a useful amount of time and energy for us to be spending on anything, are also going into programs that don't actually provide societal benefits. They instead break societal ties. And so the process of defunding the police is about identifying what those things are and what that money is and figuring out whether we could better spend that money on programs that eliminate our need for spending that money in the first place. So just as we don't need to be, you know, we don't need to have tons of nonviolent offenders behind bars on the government dime, because we taxpayers pay to house and feed people who are in jail. We don't need to do that if they don't need to be in jail. If there is no public safety reason that you need to be in jail, then I don't know why taxpayers are being asked to buy your food. What we could be asked instead is to buy your food on the outside. If you are a person who's making a choice between committing a nonviolent crime and not eating, and that is a more humane way to buy your food that also allows you to become a part of society. So there's a number of things that we can do to kind of reorient what our priorities are and what actually provides public safety versus public retribution. You know, what so when we talk about, you know, people kind of are talking about defunding the police, and then the kind of end point of that is abolish the police. And again, abolishing the police is not an idea that is meant to abolish public safety. It is meant to abolish the need for this kind of policing by investing in other things. And so you don't have to be like afraid of the idea of defunding the police. Like, that is not meant to make it so that murderers are running rampant everywhere and no one can do anything about it. It's meant to provide appropriate services so that a lot of the things that we police as if they are crimes or violent crimes or dangerous to society are instead unnecessary and covered by people that don't need to, you know, monitor them violently, but can provide support to people instead of punishing them.
Right. Yes, you're exactly right. So, you know who isn't afraid of defunding the police?
The Minneapolis City Council.
That's who.
They're about to, they just voted to support dismantling their police department.
A veto-proof majority.
I mean.
Which is funny because earlier today, the mayor was at a protest and got asked if he would commit to it. And he said no. And he literally got booed out of the protest.
Well,
he,
don't like, show walked, up at a protest.
Walked away in shame from the protest.
But this, I think one thing we need to remember is, you know, because of the political power of police unions and the way that we have allowed them to conduct themselves, mayors are fucking terrified of their police forces.
Oh my God.
The police force is who tried to destroy de Blasio in his first term. If you're wondering why de Blasio is like total weak sauce over every single thing that's been going on in.
Right, it's because he tried to get rid of Stop and Frisk.
He tried to get rid of Stop and Frisk and nearly lost his job over it. So he's terrified of the police. Garcetti is not willing to get rid of Michael Moore because he's fucking scared of the police.
Yeah.
We need to figure out a way for people to have some political courage here. Because
so good work,
good I mean,
God bless
what a world.
Yeah,
the Democrats in Congress are claiming that they're going to have a sweeping police reform bill tomorrow. If I had to guess, that's going to be the epitome of half measures that don't do anything.
They're going to
way through.
Right.
All sorts.
And
of
also,
things.
Like, I'm down for them to try and show some sort of like national leadership on this, but like also with all due respect to them, there's minimal things that the federal government can do about police forces.
It's a local.
They just don't oversee local police forces.
Yeah. I mean, they can
set. Yes, they can make some, they can set like federal law to be like, okay, like this is not a thing that like we in America are going to do. And then like police forces like can't do it. Like, but I mean, it's hard for them to sort of like really nail down in any sort of granular way to deal with some of the problems that these police forces have. It's just hard for the federal government to
do. And a lot of
I applaud them like trying because it's important. I think it's important to see the federal government like acknowledging that like there's an issue and then attempting to like make a change. But like also it's just sort of not their job.
I was going to say though that one thing that I think it's worth keeping in mind about the police is that they're an incredibly hierarchical institution. And so instead of just trying to get them to reform specific policies that don't do anything, it does make a quick difference, not enough of a difference, not a we change your role in society difference, to change the leadership to something else. The police police leadership matters a lot, and that's not something congressional Democrats can do something about, but it is something that your local elections have a huge part in. If you are struggling to find the connection between who you're voting for and how you can make a change on this issue, one easy change that you can do without changing your rhetoric that you want to abolish the police is you can elect local officials who will at least abolish their leadership. Because right. the police, in being as militarized as they are incredibly hierarchical. And as much as the culture of policing is troublesome, part of what keeps it troublesome is that the people at the top rise their way through the ranks of a troublesome police department. Yep. So you do not need to abide by the tradition of how the police department has been operating. And that's something your local officials can do something about. And it's something yes. that your federal officials can apply pressure on your local officials to do.
Right. And that is what I think that they are attempting to do.
That is what we should hope that they're going to do here. And it's also something that you should be asking your local congresspeople to make their voice heard on as it affects their district. You know?
Oh, for sure. That was one of the things that I spent a lot of time doing this week, actually, was I looked at everybody who had endorsed right. Jackie Lacey, who's our
district attorney. And then Brent wrote a letter and let me copy his letter so that I could also contact all of my elected right. officials.
Because there was sort of like one of the action items this week was to, in Los Angeles, was to email whoever your county supervisor was. And I was like, I'm sure a bunch of other people like looked at endorsed Jackie Lacey. Yeah. And like most elected officials like have their endorsements on their webpage. So I just looked. Meanwhile, it was like every single person. It was Dianne Feinstein. It was yeah. Adam Schiff. It was like the county assessor. It was every single elected official had endorsed Jackie Lacey just for God knows why. So I just, you know, like these are easy things that you can do also. But like certainly if you're not going to email somebody about Jackie Lacey, certainly at least vote for whoever's running against Jackie Lacey.
Yeah, well, right, exactly. No, but also ask that all of your elected officials be accountable to anything they can be accountable
to. They can be accountable for it, right?
Because your congressperson cannot change who your police chief is, but they can call the mayor and you can't. So, I mean, you can write an email to the mayor that they'll put a form letter in response to, and you should do that anyway. That's not to suggest you shouldn't, but like, there are layers of pressure that they can apply that you can't. So it still right. is on them to do something.
Yeah.
In any case.
Oh, boy.
I don't know why we mentioned this Tom Cotton op-ed here in the notes, but it is also notable that the New York Times opinion editor resigned after the Times ran an op-ed by Tom Cotton that was basically endorsing, it was like a call for fascism.
Yeah, and it was like a call to send in the police. I think that's what the title was.
A call
was,
to
like,
send in the army. Police. He was going to send in the military. That's what I mean. The soldiers. Yeah, yeah. The big police. And that we should, among other things, also not elect people who want to do that.
Exactly.
And in any case, in final news, Donald Trump did something very Donald Trump this week.
Right. We thought we'd end with something ridiculous.
Right.
It's
been a tough week.
And it's easy to find with Donald Trump.
That's right. On Friday, Trump
he was in Maine.
To Maine. He went on a tour of a facility that makes medical swabs that they use for coronavirus testing. And the swabs were being manufactured in the background during his visit. But then we found out...
He was some funny pictures of him sort of like...
Looking at swabs.
Playing with them and looking at them and doing...
Well, and there's been a swab shortage. So it's like actually important that we manufacture these regularly. Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's going to continue to be a shortage because all of those have to be thrown out because he wouldn't wear a mask.
They basically decided to manufacture a bunch of swabs for show while he was there so that they could play along and be good sports, but they had to throw them all away. God. So Maine, which doesn't have enough swabs, is going to continue to not have enough swabs because on Friday we wasted a whole day of manufacturing swabs on having the president do a photo op. His photo op antics this week have been outrageous.
The what have this
His
week?
His photo op antics. All week he's been doing problematic photo
Seriously.
Op.
Seriously. Yeah.
It's like a nonstop photo op deluge. Yeah. I said that word in a really weird way.
Deluge.
Whatever. Different word. Downpour. In any case, that's the news this week. I can tell that it's time to go because a huge helicopter is flying over my house.
I know. It's been
nonstop
calm in our neighborhood helicopter-wise.
Not my neighborhood.
Actually. Oh, interesting.
Not right over my house. Helicopter City over here.
There was a big one in Hollywood today, and you're closer to Hollywood than
me. I was going to say, I was going to pop my head out and see if I wanted to just jump in to do a little marching, but I didn't have quite enough time. But I think that might have been why there was... A helicopter Probably. Over my head.
Yeah.
In any case, that will continue.
All right.
See you in the streets. If you live near a protest, wear a mask, but certainly go.
Wear a mask. I have been so happy with the amount of, like, everybody is really committed to the mask wearing.
Yes, the protests are very, well, because they're polite.
Everybody is wearing a mask. People are passing out masks.
That's right.
Like, if there is, first off, you should have a mask anyway, but, like, everybody, I have felt very safe at these protests, yeah. even though that's, I'm sure, sort of like, at least on some level, a false sense of security, right. because, like, you know, whatever. Well, also, but, like, everybody is at least committed to the idea of keeping everybody else safe there. Like, exactly. it's a very sort of, and that makes you sort of, like, feel good about being there, is all I'm saying.
Well, that's
so,
what's
like,
nice
I think
about
it's an easy
protests,
place to be
so
and feel comfortable being there.
Right. Protests are their own ecosystems, and they often really make you feel great about humanity, even as you are, as a group, facing the worst in humanity. Because there's something nice about, totally. Like, even as you are dealing with a horrible police force that is trying to gun you down and fire you with tear gas and all of this, you also see kinds of cooperation in protests, especially in impromptu protests, that are actually pretty exciting. You see people who volunteer to direct traffic. You see people who volunteer to assist people who are in, you know, who are in need. You see people who just go and buy water and hand it out because someone needs to bring water and snacks.
Oh yeah, I did that.
Yeah, Brent was a water bringer on Wednesday. Yeah, so you see kinds of cooperation that also make you think that, like, maybe everyone is not just like a horrible human being. That we don't live in just like a giant shit pile. That for the most part, people are good and want to help, and that we are working against bigger systems that we have to work together to defeat, but that we are actually working together to defeat them. So if you also feel down on humanity because everything has been a giant shit show all week and all of the last 3 months, it's also a good thing to go to a protest because you 100%. Can get to see people cooperate in positive ways and also even disagree respectfully. All over the place. And that's a nice thing to see.
Totally.
So, you know.
That's a good note to end on.
That's right. We'll be back next week. We're back on track. And we will hopefully see you out in the streets before then. That's if not, we'll talk to you Wednesday. Wednesday. Sunday. I don't know the days of the week. We'll talk to you then. Bye.
Bye.